This is special programming on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. I'm News Director Sarah Bohannon. Tonight we'll hear from Congressman John Garamendi and get a peek inside the institutional response to COVID-19. We'll look into why some North State counties received an F grade from the company Unicast on their social distancing efforts, and we'll get an update on Corning schools, as well as a few tips on how to cope during this crisis. We'd love to hear from you. Give us a call on our message line, 433-9216, or head to our website, mynspr.org. For Monday, April 6th, 2020, this is special coverage from North State Public Radio. First, the news.
For NSPR News, I'm Ken Duvall. A fifth North State resident has died from COVID-19, Shasta County health officials reported Sunday. The patient was a man in his 60s who tested positive March 27th. Three deaths have now occurred in Shasta County and two in Sutter County. In all, authorities are reporting 72 confirmed deaths throughout the North State. Shasta County has reported 20, Sutter 16, Butte 12, and Yuba 10. Siskiyou County is reporting 4 cases. Colusa and Plumas report 3 cases each. Glenn reports 2, and a single case has been reported in Tehama County. Lassen and Trinity report no documented cases of the virus. Throughout California, numbers continue to rise alarmingly. A total of 5,585 are hospitalized, 1,600 of them in intensive care battling COVID-19 or COVID-19-like symptoms. The infection is also spreading among medical workers. Nearly 200 healthcare workers had been infected as of Saturday. There have been 319 deaths in California. That's a threefold increase over last week. Additionally, corrections officers reported 53 confirmed cases among prison guards and employees and 17 among inmates. Responding to an urgent shortage of ventilators in New York City and elsewhere, Governor Newsom announced the state would temporarily loan 500 ventilators to a national stockpile. Newsom said if the tables were turned, other states would come to our aid. Medical equipment, cots, and supplies are filling up the gymnasiums at Yuba City High and River Valley High, where authorities are preparing to potentially treat a surge of patients. The sites would accommodate patients considered stable but still in need of monitoring should local hospitals be overwhelmed. Officials say they've obtained 500 cots and say the facilities are precautionary. Meanwhile, Air National Guard units were transporting similar items to establish a 125-bed field medical station in Chico at the Enloe Rehab Center on East Avenue. Unscrupulous retailers trying to cash in on the crisis may find themselves in legal trouble. Newsom signed an executive order Friday prohibiting price increases exceeding 10% on food, consumer goods, medical, or emergency supplies. The order grants additional powers to the state attorney general. Finally, workers considered essential should have an easier time securing childcare in the coming weeks. Another order signed by Newsom Saturday changes eligibility requirements, letting children of healthcare workers, grocery clerks, and first responders be signed up with fewer roadblocks. The order directs the Departments of Education and Social Services to roll out rules by tomorrow. For NSPR News, I'm Ken Duvall.
This is special coverage on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. COVID-19 has upended everyday routines, generated panic buying along with conspiracies about treatment, where the virus originated, and what next week holds. Fast-changing realities have also presented challenges to policymakers, often more deliberative than rash. For a peek inside the institutional response, NSPR's Mark Albert reached out to Congressman John Garamendi, whose district stretches from Glenn County south to the Delta. Garamendi also served as Lieutenant Governor and State Insurance Commissioner. Mark began the conversation by asking the Congressman if he's ever experienced anything similar to this pandemic.
No, and I don't believe our nation has either. We've had some very, very difficult times, horrendous times. We are now in a situation that is unique in modern American history. The death rate is high. The infection rate is higher.
There's a great uncertainty and fear about hospitals running out of personal protective equipment. What can be done to provide a little bit more of a margin of error before local medical facilities do run out of important and critical equipment?
This is an issue for which I have very serious disagreement with the Trump administration. I've talked to the head of FEMA, key people within the White House, not the president, but others. To date, they basically have been saying that it is the responsibility of the state to get the equipment that they need, from personal protection equipment to respirators and ventilators. And the result is a very chaotic situation in which we find ourselves bidding against ourselves and bidding against other countries. I said 2 months ago, use the Defense Production Act, organize production of the equipment, use the full purchasing power to sign master contracts with companies that could produce a specific amount of millions of items, and they would get paid for it. And so that the bidding war that's going on and the confusion that's going on would not happen.
Congress and the president signed into law $2.2 trillion stimulus or rescue package. 10 million people have been laid off from work. They're losing their employer-based health insurance. What should be done on a policy standpoint? Are the protections more or less adequate and that things will work out?
No, definitely not. What has been done thus far is clearly not adequate. The impact on employment is far more than the current programs would provide. Therefore, we are now, at least the Democrats in Congress, are moving to do two new bills. One bill is to augment the support for cities, counties, and states, because their revenue is drying up. The second piece of legislation will be a jobs program, infrastructure, broadband, schools, construction programs of all kinds, augmenting the programs for transportation across the nation, all kinds of transportation.
Do you think that those have any chance of passage as standalone bills, or that the Democrats kind of made a strategic blunder by not trying to wrap that in with the large appropriation?
It was not a strategic blunder. The president and the Senate refused to do it. We couldn't get it through the Senate or the president.
Congressman Garamond, I know you have a large family. Between traveling to D.C. for votes, meeting constituents, and ordinary things at home, if you're willing to share, how has your own life personally changed? And how are you and your family dealing with this crisis?
Well, let me start a slightly different place. Almost 4 weeks ago, I instructed my district staff to not go out to the various meetings that they usually go out to. Almost 3 weeks ago, we shut down our offices in the district and said, we're going to do everything remotely. In Washington, almost 3 weeks ago, we began to limit meetings that we had in our office, put a big sign up on the door, no, we don't do handshakes anymore, and we do social distancing. And so my work is now about 10 hours of phone calls a day, trying to keep my iPad and my iPhone charged. My family has been social distancing. There are six of our grown children. They're doing social distancing. They're staying at home. However, four members of my family are in the healthcare business. One is an ER doctor. Another is a nurse at a hospital. Fourth is a public health professional for one of the counties here in the state. So they are every day exposed, and they go back to their home and their children and with considerable worry. So the personal protective equipment issue is front and center in this family. And I hear about it every day as they face a very risky life and a very risky job. But they're determined to continue to perform those services. And they're very brave, along with thousands of other first responders and healthcare professionals. It's a very dangerous and a very difficult time for my family. And I know it even more so for every family out there. There's never been anything like this in our lifetime. It is very, very important that we carry out this social distancing, that we stay at home, and we follow the advice of the healthcare experts. There's a lot of information out there on the web that is just wrong and, frankly, very, very dangerous. Watch the state government websites, the federal government websites, and be very aware that incorrect and dangerous information is on the web and often taken as the appropriate things to do. Experts like Dr. Fauci and Dr. Brooks need to be paid attention to.
That was Congressman John Garamendi representing California's 3rd District, speaking with NSPR's Mark Albert. How are we doing with social distancing? Well, last week, the Sacramento Bee put out a story about just that, and it showed that all California counties are not the same, with some in the North State even increasing their movement slightly, and a few receiving an F grade. The data was collected by a New York-based company called Unicast. It used location pings put out by people's cell phones. To learn more about the possible reasons behind the poor performance scores of many of the counties in our region, I spoke with one reporter who wrote the story, Ryan Sabalo. He first told me about California's performance.
California has done remarkably well. We've limited movement by about 48%. But if you look, the small, rural, tend to be impoverished counties are moving, if not as much as they did before. So yeah, the small rural counties have basically kept moving almost as much as they have before the pandemic started. And I think there's some pretty obvious reasons why. And you talk to experts, you talk to residents, and they all kind of agree on this. And it's because these small rural counties tend to have a lot more of the essential service jobs that are exempt from these orders. You have a lot more farm workers. You have more people working at trucking, logging. People are still going to work. I wouldn't really describe it as not doing as well. It's more that by the nature of where they live and what they do, they're less likely to be able to do the things like telecommuting or just staying home in general.
Are there any other possible reasons that you found for that too? Because I know you spoke to a few officials. I feel like I'm seeing, Tehama County supervisor. Are there any other reasons that people were thinking that people might still be moving around in those rural areas?
Well, there's a couple things at play here. I mean, for one, if you live in a place like Trinity County, for instance, you are probably going to have to go to Redding to get groceries. It's a long way to go. And so just by nature of trying to resupply and that sort of thing, you're going to be moving around. And I think that's fair to say. If you look, we also did our own data analysis. And, you know, there's a fair amount of correlation between people who are Republican or Trump supporters in these places too. And if you look at some of the national polling data, you'll see that there's been a lot more, I think it's changed since in the last few weeks, but early on during the pandemic, there was a lot more skepticism that this was a big deal. You had the president saying at times it wasn't as big of a deal. And so I suspect that some of that's at play. My primary assumption about the data is just it's mostly because people have these essential jobs that require them to go to work.
There are many things at play. I think it's important for people to understand.
Yeah, and I think that the fact that that Unicast gave the rural counties an F rating, you know, a lot of folks were offended by that, and I could understand why. If you're a long haul truck driver, or you're working at a warehouse, or you're a farm worker, it's like, well, you're basically penalizing me for being an essential service or being an essential worker for doing the things I need to do, and I could understand that. But there's also, you know, these cultural and regional issues at play here that I think is worth talking about as we move forward with this. One other thing I'd like to talk about, too, that I thought was really, really interesting was the correlation between tourist regions and distance travel. If you look at places like Napa, you look at Mono County, they were at the top of the list, the counties that received A grades from Unicast. It makes sense that, you know, if you shut down the tourism industry, there's folks are just going to stop moving in those places. And so you see that reflected in the data as well.
That was Sacramento Bee reporter Ryan Sabalo. You can read the article, California, You're Doing a Great Job at Staying Home, Tracking Data Show, Except These Places, at sacbee.com. You're listening to special coverage on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. More just ahead. This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. Isolation in California has now been happening for about 3 weeks, and there has been a lot of information to keep up with. One story we've been trying to make sure we follow at North State Public Radio is that of schools. What's happening? How are students, teachers, and administrators dealing? To answer a few of those questions, NSPR's host of Blue Dot, Dave Shlom, spoke with Jared Kaler, the superintendent of Corning Schools, to learn more about what the rest of the school year is likely to look like. Dave started the interview by stating that, even though the state superintendent advised schools remain closed through the end of the school year, it's up to individual school districts to decide how their schools are actually run on a day-to-day basis during this pandemic.
Yeah, I think that is one of the important things for the public to understand throughout all this is that even though there's been certain guidance issued from the state at the state level regarding public schools and whether or not they're supposed to be open and what they're supposed to do, not all of that guidance has been mandated. And so when the guidance isn't mandatory, then it's up to local school boards or local decision makers to make those decisions on closure. And so for us, that decision was made late last week. And in Tama County, we couched our decision around the governor's stay-at-home order. And so essentially we've said we're closed indefinitely until the governor rescinds his stay-at-home order. And so that way we have something firm to look to help us communicate with our families and kind of have us all be looking towards the same finish line, hopefully.
Well, that makes perfect sense. Let's talk about some of the big issues going on right now, especially for parents and students. Let's talk about graduating seniors. What are your thoughts about how this is going to work for seniors to graduate and what's that possibly going to look like?
It would be important for people to know that that question is tied to a lot of other decisions that have to be made, and they're all really tied back to this term that everybody keeps hearing, which is distance learning. And so when our schools were closed, one of the mandates that we received and one of the things that we wanted to do was continue to educate our students as best we could. And so this distance learning model or idea has emerged. And so from that, all of these other questions arise. And one of them is, how are you going to allow your seniors an opportunity to graduate? That ties directly back to the question of distance learning because it has to do with how we issue grades and how we issue credit. And so the distance learning kind of effort has a lot of things attached to it. And sometimes those things differ whether your students in a K-8 district, a kindergarten through eighth grade district, or a ninth through 12th grade district, or a unified district that has them all. And so depending on where students attend, those issues are being handled by those districts differently based on all those factors. For us, we realized early on as an only high school district that we weren't going to be able to make any other decisions until we figured out how to issue credit to students for work. And so we basically just moved forward and said, hey, students, this distance learning is going to count as credit towards graduation, and it is going to be something that is important, for you in terms of meeting your goals, so make sure that you're doing it. And so once we were able to establish that, then we can look towards the actual ceremony and special pieces of graduation and say, we're taking care of the credit piece, but the ceremony piece, we still don't have enough information to make that decision yet. So what we've told our community is that obviously we recognize how special it is, and we want to do everything we can to make sure there's some recognition of it. We've got every option on the table how we do that. Hopefully, you know, best case scenario, we'd be able to just graduate like we planned to. But if not, you know, we could delay it. We could modify the ceremony somehow. But all of that is going to depend on the guidance that's coming from state public health officials and the governor's office and federal officials as well in terms of social distancing and all those things. So we can't really make a decision until we get much closer and know what the circumstances around COVID-19 are going to look like before we can make a call on graduation.
Can you give us a sense of some of the issues involved with whether, you know, how you decide to, you know, issue a student a grade like an A, a B, a C, the traditional grades, or whether to go to credit, no credit? Can you give us kind of like the either side arguments?
Sure. So I think the central issue here that everybody needs to be considering when we're having the grading conversation is how we provide an equitable opportunity for our students to access the curriculum or access the learning, right? And so we have lots of different considerations that go into that and then tie into grades. So for our English learner students or our students with disability or our students who don't have access to devices, or actually the thing that we're realizing is a much bigger issue than device access is internet access and connectivity in our rural area. And even with the efforts made by companies like Google to provide access to rural schools, there's not necessarily always cell phone coverage for Wi-Fi hotspots and things like that out in a lot of the areas that we serve. So for us, those are all considerations that we have to make when we think about grading, because we want to make sure that every student has an equitable opportunity to achieve the grades that they've earned. And if they have some of those barriers that I just listed, then it's our obligation to make sure we're supporting them. And so providing flexibility around grading allows us the opportunity to potentially do that and relieve a burden from our teachers of having to say, okay, you know, this packet work that we're issuing isn't, you know, as high quality as it would be if we were in class. How do I judge an A versus a B now because I'm not in class with the students every day? So there are these arguments about going to more of a pass-fail model for equity purposes, for relieving this burden on teachers to try to differentiate between an A and a B sort of thing. There are some arguments that way. I would say the major thing that we've identified that it would hurt or that it would be a negative if we just went to pass-fail at this point has been those students who are taking advanced coursework to try to raise their GPAs. They would miss out on that opportunity this semester. Those pass-fail grades would not count towards a higher GPA. They would just count as passed. So that would be the one major drawback, I think.
As you've gone through this, what's one or two of the biggest obstacles that you've faced at the very beginning that you feel like you've overcome, that the school district, you know, your school district has conquered? Tell us like some of your big success stories.
Yeah, I think the thing that we're most proud of at this point is just doing our best to get something out to our community that would provide a sense of normalcy and routine for them. And so the speed with which we were able to organize and put together and execute a plan, albeit not a perfect one, for those first couple weeks, I just couldn't have been more proud of our team here. You know, everybody from administration to classified staff to certificated staff. It was just a real great effort. And then on the food service side, we're serving literally hundreds, if not thousands, of meals daily. So just that service to our community in this time has been something that we've been really proud to watch.
Okay, so going forward, what are some of the biggest obstacles you still have in the way?
I think our biggest obstacles at this point are just the unknowns that we're facing still. We don't know what we don't know at this point. There are a lot of things that we're working on trying to figure out answers to, but we also have to step back and realize that we went from operating a system that's, you know, been pretty well established for over 100 years in terms of public education and how we deliver that. And we're trying to completely reinvent that on the fly, build it as we go. And so that's the caution that I just keep giving to our staff, trying to remind people that, you know, this is a new thing and there's going to be mistakes and we have to stay together through it. And so, you know, that for me is the biggest obstacle, just knowing that there are going to be unforeseen barriers that we run into until this is over and probably beyond, things that we couldn't have anticipated even 2 months ago that we're going to have to try to deal with. So just trying to remain together through those challenges once the newness of the situation is worn off, I think will be our biggest challenge, and same challenge for a lot of people probably.
That was Jared Kaler, superintendent of Corning Schools, speaking with NSPR's host of Blue Dot, Dave Schlom. I don't know about you, but I'm starting to feel these past few weeks of isolation. So I thought it would be a good time to check in on ways that we can cope better through this pandemic. For the answers, I turned to Jocelyn Wiener, a reporter at CalMatters who covers mental health. She recently spoke to numerous therapists, psychiatrists, and psychologists and put together a list of tips she says stuck out to her.
One thing was just to sort of acknowledge the feelings that we're having, the sadness, fear, anxiety, trauma, grief, and just sort of be aware of them and okay with that. And in that way, sort of try to not let those feelings control us. And then they had some tips about ways to do that. One was just to work on mindfulness, meditation, breathing, yoga, taking calming walks. They gave some suggestions of different apps that you can use. And then beyond that, limiting the news intake. Obviously, I work for the news, and yet even I am feeling like there's just an endless number of stories that you can be reading, and it can be very stressful. So trying to know about yourself kind of what's appropriate and not read right before bed, which I have been guilty of doing. They suggested keeping a schedule, so not having like your teenager sleep till 1 p.m. and staying up till 3. For everyone, you know, get up, get dressed, and then try to do a mix of like being outside, doing exercise, doing work or school. A few people brought up that this is a really good time to try to pursue a hobby or something that you maybe have always wanted to do, which I know for some of us that's hard in terms of all the other things we're juggling. But one of the psychologists pointed out that one can feel like things are out of control to try and master something, even if it's just like a recipe that you wanted to learn, or if it's like some art project or anything that would potentially allow you some mastery, can also give you a little bit more of a sense of control over things in your life. And definitely reaching out to other people. Loneliness is a real concern. Making sure that people who are potentially isolated around you know that you're there. And as part of the idea of practicing kindness and thinking about the needs of other people, even if it's just writing, having your kids write thank you notes to healthcare workers, or paying household employees who maybe can't come to work, or whatever it is you can do to sort of get out of your own head, has the benefit of potentially helping someone else and also helping you. And also reminding yourself of all the people out there who are doing their best to slow down the virus and remembering that you're not alone in this.
That was CalMatters reporter Jocelyn Wiener speaking about her article, How to Get Past the Coronavirus Crisis Without Losing Your Mental Health. You can read the full list of tips at calmatters.org. And that's your program for Monday, April 6, 2020. While we want to bring you all the news we can, we also want to highlight the good things that are happening out there in our region. If you want to give someone a shout out for good work they're doing, leave us a message on our message line, 433-9216. That's 433-9216. Tonight's special coverage was produced by Mark Albert, Ken Duvall, Christian Solis, Andre Bayek, and Phil Wilkie. Our technical producer is Matt Fidler. Special thanks to Dave Schlom. Thank you for being with us. I'm Sarah Bohannon, news director at North State Public Radio, and this is Special Coverage. We'll be back tomorrow evening at 6:30. Until then, stay safe, stay informed, and stay tuned.